On a cloudy, rainy December afternoon several years ago, a beach baron crashed into a residential area near Page Field, which serves the city of Fort Myers, Florida. The pilot was in the process of executing a missed approach when he lost control of the airplane. This accident involved a number of factors which illustrate how an otherwise uneventful flight can become a nightmare in a short period of time. This analysis is based on the NTSB factual report and, as always, is presented as a learning opportunity, with the hope that should you ever find yourself in similar circumstances, you will remember this pilot's problems and take appropriate action to prevent a bad outcome. The PIC was a 70-year-old private pilot with single, multi-engine, and instrument ratings. He had a total of 911 hours of pilot time, 212 hours of multi-engine time, which included 186 hours in the accident airplane, and 71 hours of instrument time. Prior to picking up the brand new Baron at the Beach factory about a year before the accident, he had attended a ground and flight instruction course for the Baron at the Flight Safety International Center. The airplane was well equipped with avionics, including a three-axis autopilot, dual GPS systems, a storm scope, color radar, and an air data system capable of displaying fuel consumption and fuel remaining. The Baron was equipped with a 200-gallon fuel tank system. The pilot filed an IFR flight plan prior to departing St. Joseph, Missouri that morning, and while there's no evidence either way, we assume he obtained a weather briefing, which would have made him aware of the presence of a cold front located across Florida and moving to the southeast. His destination was Naples, Florida, where the weather was forecast to be VFR, with the possibility of broken to overcast cloud cover at 1,000 to 2,000 feet and visibility of 3 to 5 miles at arrival time. Although that forecast was right on the edge with regard to the requirement for an alternate airport, the approach of a cold front in South Florida in the middle of winter should always be a concern. Cold air mixing with abundant moisture from the Gulf of Mexico makes fog and low ceilings a strong possibility. Nevertheless, the pilot of the Baron did not file an alternate. Before takeoff, the pilot fueled his airplane carefully, ordering only 15 gallons per side, because, as he told the lineman, he was concerned about the airplane being overweight. There is no evidence of the amount of fuel in the tanks prior to fueling. This particular Baron's empty weight was 4,041 pounds, with a maximum allowable gross weight of 5,500 pounds. Considering two adults and a nominal amount of baggage, there was probably room for nearly 1,000 pounds of fuel. At about the halfway point in the trip, the pilot landed at Centerville, Alabama for fuel and took on a total of 60 gallons. He filed an IFR flight plan for the remaining leg to Naples, listing an estimated time en route of 2 plus 30 with 4 hours and 15 minutes fuel on board, or about 765 pounds of fuel. He also got a weather update at Centerville. Ceilings and visibilities in Florida were maintaining close to the forecast values, but the temperature dew point spreads were remarkably small throughout the state. Especially in South Florida, the differences were only 3 or 4 degrees, and at several airfields there was no spread at all. Not a good sign. Once again, the pilot failed to file an alternate in his IFR flight plan. The Baron continued southeastbound toward Naples and at 2:40 p.m. checked in with the Fort Myers radar controller, who instructed the pilot to advise when he had received the Naples ATIS and to expect the VOR approach to runway 23 at Naples, circle to land runway 32. About a minute and a half later, the pilot advised he had the current ATIS information and was still on frequency 3 minutes later when the radar controller broadcast an updated ATIS. The Naples weather was now 2 miles in light rain and mist with a ceiling of 500 overcast. The Baron pilot was shortly cleared to descend and maintain 5,000, cleared direct Naples, and was changed to another approach control frequency. The new controller descended the flight to 3,000, then turned the Baron southbound, explaining that the pilot would be vectored across the final approach course for sequencing into the Naples airport. In the next 2 minutes, the Baron was descended to 2,000 feet, the final approach altitude for the runway 23 approach, and was turned to a heading of 270 to intercept the final approach course. When the pilot reported established, the controller advised he was now about 12 miles from the airport, cleared for the VOR runway 23 approach, circle to land on runway 32. While the pilot was maneuvering for the approach, the ceiling at Naples had dropped to 300 feet overcast, and the temperature dew point spread was zero. Immediately after the pilot acknowledged the approach clearance, the controller said, "I got two people that have missed, and one Comanche just made it, and a west wind is ahead of you." The Baron pilot acknowledged, and 90 seconds later, the controller had more bad news. That west wind did execute a missed approach. Radar services terminated 8 miles from the airport, and contact Naples Tower 128.5. Well, three of the four preceding pilots were unable to complete their approaches. That should have been no surprise. With a minimum descent altitude of 500 feet, chances of acquiring visual contact with a 500-foot MDA were slim to none. Terrible odds for the Baron pilot. He must have been very busy. He didn't contact Naples Tower until 7 minutes had gone by, and when he did, he made it clear he was not going to try again. Fort Myers departure, I missed the approach into Naples. Wonder if I could go up to Page and shoot the ILS up there. The Naples controller had anticipated the miss and instructed the pilot to turn right heading 330, climb and maintain 3,000. Now, you need to understand that the Naples airport does not have an ILS. The nearest one is at Southwest Florida International Airport, about 20 miles north of Naples. The next nearest is Page Field in Fort Myers, 26 miles north of Naples. The controller cleared the Baron pilot to Page Field via radar vectors for the ILS runway 5 approach. The Page Field weather was now 3 miles in light rain and mist, ceiling 300 overcast. In those conditions, the 3-mile visibility was academic because, at best, the pilot would need to fly nearly all the way down to decision height before seeing the runway. This was going to be a demanding approach for the Baron pilot. During the next several minutes, the Baron continued on vectors toward Page Field. The pilot was advised of his position 5 miles from Kalu, that's the final approach fix for the ILS, was cleared to descend and maintain 2,000 feet, the glide slope intercept altitude, was given a vector of 030 to intercept the localizer, and advised to contact the Page Tower on frequency 119.0. There was no communication from the Baron on the tower frequency for 4 minutes, during which the approach controller and the tower controller tried to establish radio contact to figure out what was going on. The Baron pilot had apparently decided to fly the full approach, including a procedure turn, even though he had been assigned a heading to intercept the localizer at a 20-degree angle. The tower controller was apparently monitoring the procedure on his local radar because he advised the approach controller, he's going outbound to do it on his own. Now, flying the full approach, including a procedure turn, is, of course, a pilot option, but it's important to let the controllers know what you're doing. After all, there were other pilots operating in the Fort Myers airspace. In this case, flying an unnecessary procedure turn ate up valuable time. The weather wasn't getting any better, to say nothing of the fuel that was burned. In any event, the Baron pilot was having a great deal of difficulty establishing himself on the localizer. The controller offered several vectors and position advisories in an attempt to get the Baron on course, but to no avail. At 3:32 p.m., the pilot transmitted, "Sir, I'm having very big difficulties out here. I've gone through it again," probably referring to the localizer, "and I'm climbing back to 2,000. The controller now realized the extent of the problem and immediately advised, "Radar contact, cancel your approach clearance, fly heading 310 when you can." Less than a minute later, the controller asked, "What's your fuel status?" The pilot replied, "It's down in the yellow." Controller said, "Okay, how much is that in time?" And the pilot replied, "Just a minute, I'll tell you." And a few seconds later, he said, "It's practically nil." Assessing his options, the controller asked the Baron pilot, "What are your flight conditions?" The pilot answered, "I'm above the clouds at the moment, turning 210 over to 300. The controller followed up with, "Okay, sir, I can set you up for an NDB. Do you feel more comfortable flying an NDB? The minimums are a little higher, though." And the pilot replied, "Nah, I should be up on this ILS. I was trying to do it with my automatic, and I'm going to have to fly it manual. I've got some kind of instrument problem." Given his knowledge of the Baron's low fuel state and the pilot's problems with the ILS, the controller opted to provide a radar surveillance approach to get the airplane down safely. His vectors and advisories got the pilot to within a half mile of the runway threshold and down to an altitude of 300 feet, but the pilot was unable to make visual contact with the ground. One witness said he heard loud engine noises, which stopped abruptly. Another saw a twin-engine airplane break out of the cloud base heading south at a low altitude. The Baron crashed into a garage and came to rest on a residential street in Fort Myers. There was no post-impact fire. The NTSB determined the probable cause of this accident was the pilot's spatial disorientation while flying in instrument meteorological conditions, which resulted in his failure to maintain control of the aircraft. The board added two factors which contributed to the accident: the pilot's distraction because of the low fuel status and the low cloud conditions. We don't disagree with either of those findings, but we would hasten to add fuel mismanagement and poor pilot judgment as contributing factors. But there are a lot of ifs remaining. The weather briefing in Alabama must have provided signs of the weather going downhill in Florida. If the pilot was determined to proceed, it would have been prudent to figure out how much fuel could be added and select an alternate airport before he launched on the final leg of the flight. When he was advised that three of the four airplanes ahead of him missed their approaches at Naples, the pilot would have done well to break off his approach and find an airport with more suitable weather. This option would have been particularly prudent in light of the small amount of fuel on board at the time. His low fuel state might have, by itself, put enough pressure on the pilot to erode his judgment. It's possible there was a problem with the avionics in the Baron, but not likely. In any event, aren't we as pilots in command expected to be able to fly our airplanes using basic instrumentation if necessary? Aren't PICs expected to be competent in the use of autopilots and other systems on the airplane? Perhaps this pilot's initial training in the Baron didn't extend to proper use of the autopilot and other avionics, or didn't make him completely familiar with these items. Remember his comment at the beginning of his final approach, "I should be up on the ILS. I was trying to do it with the automatic, and I'm going to have to fly it manual." Was this technically advanced airplane more than the pilot was prepared to handle in instrument conditions? Was he subject to overstress when everything he did turned sour? Had he flown this airplane recently and regularly in IFR conditions by himself? The human factors considerations in this accident loom large, and there are questions that will never be answered. On the other hand, there are lessons to be learned. Good flight planning is so very important, especially when the destination weather is questionable or when conditions start to deteriorate en route. It's always a safe practice to file an alternate on an IFR flight plan if for no other reason than forcing you to plan your fuel load accordingly. Remember, an alternate is required when the destination forecast calls for ceilings less than 2,000 feet and/or visibility less than 3 miles during the time period 1 hour before and 1 hour after your estimated arrival. And you must have enough fuel on board to get you through an approach at destination, then fly to your alternate, and still have fuel to fly for 45 minutes. On second thought, make that enough fuel for another full hour. Altitude above, runway behind, and fuel left in the truck are the three most useless commodities for any pilot. Before we leave the subject of fuel exhaustion, consider this. Even if you never venture outside the traffic pattern, there may come a day when you'll be thankful for every minute of flying time you can squeeze out of the tanks. Someday there won't be selective fuel systems on any general aviation single-engine airplanes except the antiques. Instead, there will be fuel systems that are either on or off, no selection of right or left or center or wingtip or auxiliary. If you can get the engine running, it should run until the gas is gone. That's a good deal because it will keep some pilots from coming to an untimely end through selecting an empty tank. In the meantime, you will probably have a fuel selector in your airplane, giving you at least a selection of left, right, or both. You might be amazed to find there might be a big difference between the amount of fuel actually in those tanks and what you have always thought was there when the needle pointed to F. Rather than just bore holes in the sky on your next trip, make a fuel consumption check. Fill both tanks, or all four, or whatever you've got, and start, taxi, run up, take off and climb on one or the other, whatever you like, but arrive at your normal cruise altitude with an untapped supply. As soon as you have the airplane set at the power setting you prefer for cruise, note the time and switch to the full tank. If the trip isn't long enough, or at least your bladder's not strong enough, fly as long as practical, or at least an hour, to get a good check. And before changing anything else, switch back to the original fuel supply. When you get on the ground, note carefully how much fuel is required to refill the tank, and you can compute a rather accurate fuel consumption rate for your airplane at that particular cruise power setting. When you have time, do it again with a different power setting. That will furnish some useful figures for detailed long-range flight planning, and if you get a figure for the maximum endurance power setting, the one that provides as much time as possible from every drop of fuel, you'll know how long you can stay in the air if that is what's required to get you out of a jam. To find out the absolute number of minutes the airplane will fly at a fixed power setting, go through the same routine. But after you switch to the full tank, leave the selector alone until the engine quits. Now, depending on the type of airplane, you may want a suitable airport several thousand feet directly below. Time it carefully, and on some later flight, do the same with the other side and or the other tanks. You'll probably start flying by your watch instead of the fuel quantity gauges in most light airplanes. They are required to be accurate in only two conditions, completely full and completely empty. Having an accurate endurance figure lets you run to within 10 minutes or so of fuel exhaustion before switching tanks, and knowledge of the amount of time in your tanks begets confidence and utility.